Welcome to this next session on the class of Ecclesiastes, Searching for the Meaning of Life. We left off last time at the end of chapter 9, and we're going to be continuing on in this session in chapter 10. At the end of chapter 9, we had talked about the idea of death and about how being rich or how being wise or how being righteous or wicked, that basically everything, including all these different qualities of being strong, swift, understanding, or skillful, that all of them essentially can be inverted, that they don't produce the effect that one might think. The fastest person doesn't win the race. The strongest person doesn't win the battle. The wise person doesn't seem to have food. The person with understanding doesn't get wealth and riches. And the person with the skill doesn't have the favor. And that's because time and chance, Solomon says. Time and chance happen to everybody. There's unpredictability in life, he says. And that's one of his explanations for why everything seems to be an enigma. It seems to be confusing, perplexing to him. And he also talked about the universality of death and that no matter what one does, everybody's heading to one event. Everybody has the same one event in their future, death. So in chapter 10, he picks that idea up and moves forward with it. So if you have your Bible, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 10. And we're going to begin here in verse 1. Verse 1 says, dead flies cause the oil of the perfumer to give off a bad odor. So does a little folly outweigh wisdom and honor. In our modern culture, we actually have a saying that's derived from this verse. If you ever hear anybody talk about a fly in the ointment, that expression comes from Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verse 1. Where to have a fly in the ointment or a fly in the perfume here, the oil of the perfumer, that's just a fragrant oil, it ruins the fragrant. Something that you can have a whole flask of oil and something as small as a little fly gets in and dies, that dead fly or flies, plural, they contaminate the fragrance and turn it sour, putting off a bad odor. It's like having something spoil in your fridge. You ever open the door of your fridge and you just are like, whoa, something needs to go. You need to throw something away. It's spoiled. Well, that smell. Solomon here is using this idea of something small can have a very profound negative effect. And he uses this analogy to compare it to the way that folly or foolishness, that just a small pinch of foolishness can outweigh wisdom and honor. The idea here of a small bit of something, or like being more weighty or more significant than everything else, there's a number of things in our world that provide these kind of contaminating effects. Mold, bacteria, and yeast. You get a small little bit of some of that in an organic, you know, like a piece of produce, or other organic substance, and it will just permeate the whole thing until the entire space and whatever substance it is just completely thoroughly covered in it or thoroughly contaminated by it. And Solomon's going to show the way that foolishness, and basically this whole chapter is going to be a commentary on foolishness and understanding foolishness. And he wants to point out here right at the beginning that foolishness is potent. It's so potent that a little bit can completely disrupt or outweigh wisdom and honor. So let's look at some of the things he says about foolishness. A wise person's heart inclines him toward his right hand, but a fool's heart inclines toward his left. Solomon begins by contrasting a wise person and a foolish person here. The wise person's heart goes toward his right hand. Well, okay. And then the foolish person's heart is inclined toward his left hand. Well, I mean, I have two hands, right? Well, in the biblical culture, those two hands mean completely different things. In the biblical culture, the right hand was the hand of blessing, the hand of honor, and it was the hand that indicates something is done right. The right hand indicates what is right or correct. In contrast, the left hand is the hand that symbolizes cursing, symbolizes disfavor, and also things that are bad. So for the wise person's heart to go toward the right, it means that it directs the person's heart, directs him toward doing what is good, what is right, what is receiving of God's blessings. Whereas the foolish person's heart leads him down toward the left hand, which indicates that he would go be under God's curse or would receive disaster or other bad things because of it. Solomon continues on in verse 3. He says, "And also, when the fool walks on the road, his understanding fails him. And he says to everyone that he is a fool." There's no real contrast here, but Solomon's just trying to characterize a fool. And he does this by what happens when you meet a fool. He says that it will be obvious that when you meet a fool, because his understanding will fail him. And he'll tell everybody that he's a fool. Now, what exactly does that mean? Does he parade around and say, "Hey guys, I'm a fool. Hey, welcome. I'm your friendly neighborhood fool." He doesn't announce himself like that. What this is trying to say is that it is apparent by what a person says or what they do that they're a fool. Their foolishness reveals itself. It's clearly demonstrated each time the fool opens their mouth or does anything. Verse 4. Now, this verse kind of departs from his explanations about a fool for a moment because it doesn't seem like there's any connection, but he's offering a piece of wise advice here. He says that if the spirit of the ruler, which would just refer to the ruler's heart, their disposition and attitude, if the spirit of the ruler rises up against you, so if the person who's in charge gets upset with you, do not leave your place. For calmness lays great offenses to rest. What Solomon's trying to suggest here is how to handle being in the presence of somebody with authority or your superior. And if they have anger towards you, you've angered them, or they're angry about something with which you're in the object, their anger is directed towards you. It says, do not leave your place. This is interesting for him to say because previously, he talked about when you're in the presence of a king and the king tells you what to do, you're supposed to leave immediately and go do it. You're not supposed to stay there and oppose him or argue with him about it. But that's a different context because here it's not about the king or the ruler giving a command. It's about their view of you and a emotional, negative emotion towards you, most likely anger. And that if that's the case, then you're not supposed to leave. Because walking out on the ruler, like the king, if he's mad at you, will most likely just make it worse. It would just infuriate him even more. So he says, don't leave your place. Stay there and change your demeanor. Calmness. He says, calmness lays great offenses to rest. So if you have offended the person in authority, the leader, such as the king, stay there and present yourself with a calm demeanor. Now, Proverbs chapter 15 talks about this in the terms of words. It says that a gentle response turns away rage, but a hurtful word increases anger. There is something wise about presenting yourself in both your words and also in your presence, that if you have a gentle and calm demeanor or tone, that it then can come across better to somebody who is emotionally worked up, whose passions are inflamed and they are easily provoked. But being calm, he says, can help lay great offenses to rest. And if you've done wrong, it can help to smooth things over. Verse 5, Solomon brings another subject here, as we can see the introductory statements that we've been tracking with all along, where he says, I've seen this or I observed that. He says, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun. Now, this terminology of evil is like we've seen before. It's not like a moral evil necessarily. It can just be something that is wrong or upsetting, but it can refer to moral evil as well. Only case by case can we determine which reference it is. Here he says he's seen an evil under the sun. What has he seen? He's seen the sort of error. There's an error, a mistake, so that probably indicates there's a moral quality to the evil here. The sort of error that proceeds from the one who has power. So he's bringing in this idea of somebody in a position of power, a position of authority. They can do stuff. Now, what's the error? There's an error that he says proceeds from this person. He describes it here in 6 and 7. He says, folly, foolishness, this is like a personification of that quality that is being used in reference to the people who exhibit that. Folly is set in many high positions, meaning foolish people are put in charge, while the rich sit in a low place. That doesn't seem to be so bad, right? Well, I think for the foolish people to be in charge, probably not so good. But there's nothing wrong with rich people sitting in a low place. But it's the opposite, though, of what Solomon would expect. Because generally, when he looks around, he sees that people who are in elevated statuses in society are people of means. They're people of wealth. So for a rich person to not have that elevated status in society, it then raises his eyebrow like, that's odd. So these are two things that aren't really supposed to happen, meaning foolish people shouldn't be put in charge. Foolish people have no right being in charge. And you'd expect a rich person to have the social distinction that comes with that placement in society. Furthermore, verse 7, he's also seen this, servants on horses, while officials walk on the ground like servants. He's just explaining here another type of inversion where typically servants don't ride on horses. In that biblical culture, it was the officials, the people who were leaders, people in charge, they rode on horses and their servants accompanied them on foot. So if he sees things backwards, this is part of the evil. This is the error he sees with people who are in charge. Essentially, what he's trying to say is he sees a dilemma in the world that's out of order with the way it should be. And this is done by people who have power, he says. People who have power, and if they are foolish, then they put foolish people in charge, and everything gets flipped on its head. He's basically giving a very negative characterization of foolishness. And so he's trying to show how it brings about disorder in the world. Another aspect of foolishness is that it's dangerous. And in verses 8 through 11, he will go on to now show the way that foolishness can bring about personal harm. In verse 8, he says, the one who digs a pit may fall into it, and a snake may bite the one who breaks through a wall. Whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits wood may be endangered by it. These four scenarios here, the one about digging the pit, the one about breaking through the wall, the one about quarrying stone, and the one about splitting wood. Each one of these is a common profession in the ancient world, an activity, especially in an agricultural setting, that brings with it potential personal harm. If you dig a pit, there's a possibility that you will end up in it. Likewise, if you're doing construction work in that time and place, a lot of walls had all kinds of crevices that were great places for snakes to hide. And that if you were making a hole in the wall and breaking through, you'd be right close to the wall where those crevices are and could get bit by a snake that was hiding in there and that you were disrupting their home. Furthermore, if you are quarrying stone or cutting stones, if anybody's ever been to a quarry, stones are very big and very heavy, and you're right next to them. They could fall on you, and that would be fatal for sure. And splitting wood. If anybody's ever split wood, when you hit the wood to split it, it goes in at least two directions usually. And sometimes it goes in two directions very fast and far. And if you're standing, if somebody's standing there, usually you tell them to move back because they're within a radius of potential harm from flying objects like pieces of wood. In verse 10, taking this wood splitting idea, he then brings forth a metaphor from it. If the iron, basically the iron head of the axe, if it's dull and one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength. But wisdom brings success. In addition, if the snake bites before it is charmed, then there's no advantage to having a charmer. The connection between verses 10 and 11 here, they flow from 8 and 9, in at least one or two different ways. One way it could be, the connection could be that the skilled expert, that being a skilled expert doesn't remove the potential for danger and it doesn't guarantee success. Or it could be that a skilled expert will fail if they don't properly apply their knowledge in the given context. It seems that based upon verses 8 and 9, the best way to take it is that the detriment of not applying wisdom ends up resulting, typically could result in personal harm. Being foolish is essentially what he's trying to get at. That if you're trying to split wood with a dull axe, or you're not charming the snake properly, bad things result. The wise person applies the skill properly, which will result in success. Now, I think about that there are occupations that have hazards, occupational hazards, and very dangerous ones. There's a TV show that I used to watch called The Deadliest Catch, and it's a reality TV show about the crab fishermen up on the Bering Sea, I believe, of hunting for Alaskan crab. And it's one of the deadliest jobs in the world. These fishermen go out to sea for extended lengths of time on a small boat, and they face 40-foot waves, these 700-pound crab pots, which can easily cause injury if hit by one or if one gets dropped on you, which that happens in the show. And then there's swinging booms that can catch you in the head. There's dozens and dozens of sharp pointed pinchers always waiting for a available appendage to clamp onto. And there's freezing temperatures as well with getting soaking wet. Applying wisdom in those situations would help to remove some of those perils. But being foolish is what brings on a lot of the incidents that you see in the show. A lot of the things that create the drama happen around people not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Foolish mistakes. Now, Solomon transitions to talking about wisdom, only then to then set up the next description of foolishness. And the foolishness of this section is that it's delusional. Foolishness brings a delusion. He says, the words of a wise person's mouth are gracious. That's on one side, but the lips of a fool, which refers to what the fool says using their lips, say metonymy, they swallow him up. So the words of a wise person's mouth are gracious. If the parallelism with the second half lends to understanding how they're gracious, it seems that it would indicate that the wise person receives favor or grace toward them by what they say. Their wise words engender people's favor to them. Unlike the lips of a fool, what a fool says ends up coming back to bite them. The lips of a fool swallow him up. Now, how does that happen? Well, in verse 13, he says that in the beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his mouth is hurtful madness. So the beginnings of the words are just foolish. But what he's saying is that there's a progression. There's a progression in which foolish words then proceed to produce harmful outcomes, this hurtful madness. Yet, even if that is the case, he says in verse 14, the fool doesn't recognize it. The fool doesn't see the effect of the words. And that's why they come back around to swallow him up, is because he doesn't know that that's what they're doing. And so he multiplies the words. The foolishness continues to flow. It's like a positive feedback loop. Foolishness, which produces disaster and harm, then creates more foolishness, which then produces disaster and harm. But a person does not know what will be and what will be after him. Who can tell him? This is part of the conundrum here with death. That's what this is referring to. There's no ability to know the future, and there's no ability to know what happens after you die. Who can tell him? Solomon's bringing this up because it's his way of saying you can be foolish and there is consequences for that, but that's only now. Nobody knows what that then brings in the future. It's still an enigma. It's a mystery. And lastly, the delusion of the fool is seen in how they labor intensely. The labor of fools wearies them, for he does not know how to go to a city. The fool exercises more effort than necessary because they don't know what they're supposed to be doing. Solomon seems to be presenting the fool here in terms of somebody who is either completely naive or neglectful of understanding how to even carry out simple business, how to do simple work, whether they need to go to the city to actually do their work, like that's where their job is, or to know how to do trade and commerce, which happens in a marketplace in a city. And if the fool doesn't even know how to go to the city to take their goods there to sell, then they just go through all this extra effort. I mean, essentially, they probably never even make it there. But nonetheless, they exert themselves all the more to try to get there, but they never accomplish it. Foolishness is delusional. Forgetting how to go to the city is compounds the fact that they don't even have a basic understanding of life. The efforts of the fool are multiplied just like it's the fool's words because they don't see the harm that they cause. The next section, starting in verse 16, woe to you, O land, when your king is a youth and your officials feast in the morning. These two verses are going to give a negative perspective and then a positive perspective, but both of them are trying to show a point about foolishness here. This first one in verse 16, woe to you, O land, it's a way of saying, you know, that's terrible. It's very terrible, O land, and that's referring to the people in the land. If you have a king that's a child or is immature and your officials feast in the morning, these two things are improper and should not be. A child has no ability to rule and to govern properly. I'm reminded of when King Louis the 16th took the throne of France. He was 19, and a lot of his decisions, not exclusively, but a lot of history traces his decisions to the downfall of Rome, or not Rome, France, and the eventual revolution, the French Revolution. Now, when he ascended the throne at 19, he wanted to be loved by the people. I mean, when you're a teenager, popularity is a pretty important thing to you. And so one of his first actions was he wanted to reinstate the parliament that his grandfather had abolished. These were like local judiciary officials and would comprise one of the bodies that could challenge him and question him on some of his policies and decisions. Well, King Louis's advisory council told him that it was a bad idea. And they questioned as to why he wanted to make the decision to reinstate it. And this is what he said. It may be considered politically unwise, but it seems to me to be the general wish, and I want to be loved. So he went on to institute it, and as a young ruler, he made several other foolish choices that ended up causing great harm to his nation. A king shouldn't be a youth, and also officials shouldn't feast in the morning. Well, I like breakfast. You guys like breakfast? Sure, but that's not what a feast is. This is referring to the feasting, which comprises a large, ornate banquet, usually consisting of entertainment and music and drinking of wine, typically. And so that's not proper to do in the morning when the officials should be attending to the business of the state or whatever leadership capacity they're in. They should be attending to that business, not reclining to feast in the morning. Now, verse 17, from a positive perspective, blessed are you, O land. So in the beginning, it was woe, or how terrible it is for you. Now, blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles and your officials feast in due season. Why? For strength, not for drunkenness. So the contrast is when the king is the appropriate age and also from the appropriate grouping of society to be able to have the knowledge of how to rule. And when your officials eat in the proper season or at the proper time, and they do it in order to regain their strength, they do it for sustenance, not for gluttony. This is what then results in a land to be blessed, that the wisdom of that, in contrast to the foolishness of verse 16, which spells disaster for the land. Verse 18, another verse on foolishness here, this time characterizing it as laziness and idleness. It says, by laziness, the rafters sag, and through idleness of the hands, the house leaks. These two things are very reminiscent of traditional wisdom from Proverbs. I think I'll want to read to you guys Proverbs 24. Proverbs 24, verse 30 says, I passed by the field of a lazy person and by the vineyard of a person lacking sense. And behold, it was all overgrown with thistles. Its surface was covered with weeds and its stone wall had fallen down. When I noticed, I paid attention. I observed and I learned this lesson. Just a little more sleep, a little more slumber, a little more folding of the arms to lie here. And your poverty will come like a robber and your needs like an armed man. There's a lot more Proverbs that talk about laziness and idleness. And all that Solomon is trying to bring forth here is to the idea that to be lazy then has a detrimental consequence with it. The rafters sag, meaning that the house falls into disrepair and ruin. And through idleness of the hands, the house leaks. This probably refers to mismanagement of money. Could be literal as well, to where the house actually has roof leaks. And during rainy season, they would then leak through the house because that roof is not repaired. So it could have a figurative reference or a literal reference. Then in verse 19, people make food for laughter and wine gladdens one's life and money answers everything. Now, that's an interesting phrase there at the end of verse 19. Money answers everything. I don't think Solomon here is relying on money as kind of the end-all, be-all, and that if you have money, then all your life problems are solved. Money's the answer to everything. That's not the wording we should take away from. Here, in the context of enjoying the fruit of one's work, which this harkens back to the instruction of enjoying one's life by eating and drinking and being merry in one's heart. Here, food for laughter, wine gladdens one's life, and this is accomplished through money. Money brings these things about. Working hard then produces a revenue. And Solomon says elsewhere that that is supposed to be enjoyed by the one who labors. The fruit of one's labor is supposed to be enjoyed by them. And that is done by using the money to then purchase and acquire the implements of the basic necessities of life, like food and drink. All right, as we come here to the final verse, Ecclesiastes chapter 20, verse 20 in chapter 10. Lastly, Solomon says to conclude this section, do not curse the king. We've been talking about people in authority, such as kings and rulers. That's in his mind here. Do not curse the king. No, not in your thoughts. And do not curse the rich either in your bedroom. So neither one should be cursed by you, king or rich. For a bird of the air may carry your voice, and that which has wings may tell the matter. There's another modern expression that comes from this verse, which is if you ever read that somebody says, a little birdie told me so. That's derived here from Ecclesiastes 10:20, where a bird of the air will whisper, will carry what you say, will whisper it to somebody else, or something that has wings, which is also a winged creature like a bird, will tell the matter to another person. We use the phrase to refer to when you hear things from somebody else that you could say, a little birdie told me this such and such a thing. The advice here that Solomon's offering is that you're not supposed to speak ill of the ruler, like the king, or the people who have higher privilege than you in society, like the rich, because you never know who might be listening. It is foolish to talk bad about somebody behind their back, because if they find out that you did so, it would then be dishonorable to you. You would then be the fool in that circumstance. So he's coming around to talk about foolishness again in a positive light of, don't do this because that is foolish and could have serious repercussions for you. In the ancient culture, if there were things said about the king and the king learned about them, you might get arrested. You could get arrested for insubordination or sedition or for any other types of transgressions against the throne. So the final exhortation here is to use wisdom with your words, to know that you should not say things like a curse or other negative statements about anyone behind their back because someone might always be listening. Well, that concludes Ecclesiastes chapter 10. And as we come back in the next session, we're going to be entering toward the home stretch in chapter 11. So we'll see you then.